You're listening to Downtown Depot, where we track the ins and outs of Waco business. I'm your host, Austin Meek, of WacoBusinessNews.com. And my guest today is charity CEO and worship leader extraordinaire, Brett Mills. Brett and his wife, Emily, are the founders of Jesus Said Love, a nonprofit that shares the love of Christ with women in the commercial sex industry by awakening hope and empowering change. Now, those are pretty lofty goals, and we're going to dive deep into their meaning with Brett. But first, it's the word on the street. The city of Waco has talked about the importance of developing the east side of the Brazos for a long time, and last week they made a big pledge to do so. The TIF board, which controls a fund to incentivize development in areas that might otherwise go untouched, suggested an award of $956,200 for the proposed $3.8 million improvements along the Elm Avenue corridor from MLK to Garrison. The city is applying for a state-federal grant that would pay for the bulk of the streetscape improvements, which includes more than 4,000 feet of sidewalks on either side, each between 8 to 10 feet wide to promote walkability, as well as ample lighting and bike lanes to increase safety and alternative transportation options. The application is due on May 22nd, and a big part of the process is demonstrating why the Elm Avenue corridor is a more worthy use of funds than other areas in the state. I wrote a letter to TxDOT explaining how revolutionary a safe, accessible route connecting East Waco and downtown would be for the neighborhood, and a lot of other community members contributed their voices as well. It was really encouraging to see the TIF board step up, and if the city council approves their recommendation, it'll be a huge step forward for a part of town that looked like it was faltering after the Milo restaurant concept backed out. Last week, I spoke with Millette Harrison, Deputy Director of Housing and Economic Development, who said that the contribution from the city could be key to getting the larger grant because the Waco project looks much more attractive at under $3 million than it would have otherwise. In other East Waco news, Nancy Grayson's cottage project on Tyler Street is moving forward, but not without a lively discussion. J.B. Smith, who was one of my guests last month on Downtown Depot, covered the debate in his May 11th article for the Waco Trib. It pits two ladies who have proven their dedication to developing the East Side: Nancy Grayson, owner of Lula Jane's, and Megan Henderson, executive director of City Center Waco. Grayson wants to use her land at Tyler and Nathaniel McCoy as a cottage development, creating multiple 320-foot residences that all face inward toward a community courtyard. Nancy envisions neighbors living and working in community, and as she's demonstrated with Lula Jane's and the Rappaport Academy, her hunches usually turn out to be right. Henderson objects to Nancy's proposal because it runs counter to many of the development guidelines laid out in Imagine Waco, a guide that has been used to steer strategic development for nearly a decade. J.B. Smith quoted Henderson, saying, "It's an exciting, ambitious, and beautifully planned project, but we have grave reservations about a couple of aspects. To fulfill Imagine Waco, it would need to have a different scale and orientation than small cottages tucked away from the street." The TIF board recommended giving Grayson $145,384 for her project, and it's now up to the City Council and the Zoning Board of Adjustment, which would need to grant a zoning variance to allow the building to go against the Imagine Waco guidelines. Henderson is concerned with setting a precedent, and I can see her point. Quote, "There will be other developments that want us to ignore our design standards. This isn't just an aspirational design. It's not just something that would be pretty. It's about the generational development of this district and how being built to the sidewalk creates a walkable sidewalk. Now, I personally wouldn't want this development on Elm Avenue, because I agree with Megan. Building to the street creates a walkable sidewalk, and that would render a lot of the streetscape improvements moot. But this is off Elm, on Tyler, which isn't meant to be a pedestrian thoroughfare in the way that Elm is. Here is an entrepreneur with a proven track record wanting to restore a blighted part of the city. Grayson has gone on record to say that if she can't do the project her way, she'll plant trees and leave the tracks undeveloped. I'm all for more green space in the urban core, but I think clinging so tightly to design guidelines without asking why those guidelines were implemented in the first place and whether or not they should be flexible would be setting a dangerous precedent." Brett Mills' day-to-day life is one of the most unique I've encountered since moving to Waco, and he was gracious enough to swing by the KWBU studio yesterday to talk about it. Well, Brett, welcome to Downtown Depot. I am so happy that you would take your time out of your schedule and come and visit us. Now, I love starting the show every time with a question.
Uh-oh.
You tell me what brought you to Waco. What's your story in this city?
Okay, so when I was five, I wanted to go to Baylor. I turned 41 later on this week. So, yeah, I don't know why. I didn't know much
Baylor
about,
parents?
Probably, no, U of H. I'm from Houston. So yeah, when I was five, I was like, let's go to Baylor.
Wait, think back to 5-year old Brett though. There's gotta be some seminal moment.
Maybe cause this little church I went to, our pastor went to Baylor and he always talked about Baylor. I don't know. I mean, truthfully, it was like, I resolved at five, I'm going to Baylor.
Wow.
So we would come up and go to games at Floyd Casey and I would always be like that kid going, one day I'm going to be here.
What are your memories from coming up to games as a young guy?
I remember that they used to hand out these little whistle things. It was like a little half-moon piece of leather with a piece of plastic, and you shove it up in the roof of your mouth, and you would whistle. It so would be illegal today because swallowing hazard, but
yeah,
no, I vividly remember that.
And so you would come up to Waco with your family, go to Baylor games. Yep. You grew up in Houston. What was your adolescence like in high school?
I was probably that typical, random, boring, all-American kid. Didn't drink, didn't cuss, kept everything between the straight and narrow, and was everybody's friend.
Religious family,
yeah.
And then finally when you turned 18, you realized, I can finally fulfill my lifelong dream and go to Waco.
Yeah, so got accepted, made a 790 on my SAT. Which is embarrassing to say. So I took it again and made a 720.
Oh, that wasn't one section.
That was the whole
all
freaking
of the
test.
Sections.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So so then I'm like, well, I know I'm smart, but obviously I can't do these really long words. So I took the ACT and that got me in.
Yeah. So. Reading words is hard, isn't it?
Bro, yeah. I just don't even know. So I like, you know, it keeps me humble.
And when did you show up in Waco for college?
Fall of 94.
Okay. And what was the scene like?
Chili's was kind of the hoppin' place to go. About Chili's at the end of Valley Mills.
And when you were at Baylor, what were some of the things you were involved in?
My first year was just trying to figure things out, trying to navigate my newfound freedom of, okay, well, I've done this whole keep it perfect thing, so let's see what else this world has to offer. So, you know, I think 2 weeks in, I tried to keep it real, and then it was like, well, let's just start dabbling. So I started hanging out with a potential fraternity that I was going to rush and started – I think I smoked Marlboro Reds for like 2 weeks until I realized, well, this is not me. I went to a strip club, went to a local strip club here and walked in and thought, whoa, this is weird, and felt really uncomfortable. So I played pool the rest of the night.
And that uncomfortability, that was a foreign feeling for you, I guess.
Well, yeah, I mean, of course.
Like, did you understand why you felt weird?
As I think back now, yeah, I think the reason why it was weird, because I'll never forget, I don't want to get too graphic here, but I vividly remember a woman on the stage and this construction worker guy with like slick back Elvis hair. Standing as close as he could get to the stage without touching anybody. And he was just entranced. And I remember thinking, I don't want to be like that. I wasn't thinking, oh my gosh, there's a half-naked woman right there next to me. It was, I don't want to be like that guy.
Wow.
But that was the depth. It wasn't anything. I wasn't thinking, oh, is she being trafficked? And it was just, I don't want to be like that guy. So I'm going to go over here and play pool.
Well, surely that was a moment that altered the course of
well, heck
of your
yeah!
Professional
I mean,
life.
Looking back, that was definitely a marker where I look back and go, "Okay, here we are, like, you know, however many years later, almost 20 years later. Wow, who would have known?"
So, fill me in the time between that moment and when you connected with your wife Emily.
Okay, so after I completely fell off the wagon of what I felt was the wagon, you know, drinking some beer and staying out late and doing, you know, saying bad words. I mean, it gets pretty crazy, bro. I mean, you know, you say damn here and there and whoa, you're going to, you know, go to hell. So After that, I kind of turned my life around and started leading worship for a large group Bible study that was here called Choice. Louis Giglio was the founder of that, and started the end of my freshman year and then carried over to my sophomore year. He ended up leaving to go to Atlanta to start the Passion Movement, but the organization still stayed intact. So I stayed on and just led worship for college students, and it grew and grew. I had like 2,000 kids every Monday night, and totally transformed my trajectory. I wanted to be a doctor when I came to Baylor. I wanted to be a plastic surgeon of all things. But in 1995, people started calling saying, "Hey, will you come do music at our event?" And so on my weekends and sometimes during the week, I'd be traveling all over the country doing these events for conferences and retreats and camps and things like that. So in 1997, I met my wife. We were doing this big thing in Fountain Mall. We were on the big 40-foot trailer, blew out all the speakers. I mean, the whole – it was always, you know, from the fountain all the way back to the library. It was just packed people everywhere. And we blew the speakers, and then, you know, as little Christian kids like to do, they form their little pockets and start little singing their little songs that kind of, you know, float up. And I heard this voice. I'm not making this up. I heard this voice rise up above the crowd, and it's like, who is that? Well, somebody next to me knew who it was, and I said, I need to meet that girl. Met her. We went to Subway, and she thought it was a date. It was not. It was a business interview because I take this job very professionally. And so long story short, she came on the worship team, and we started singing together all over the country. And I kept telling myself, I am not going to like this girl. And I did.
And did you guys start making music together at that point?
We were doing other people's music. Okay. We didn't start doing our own music probably till we got married.
And you guys still to this day travel around making music together, performing at different conferences and for groups?
We do. Not as much as we used to. The JSL side of what we do has gotten crazy town big. So that takes up most of our time. But yeah, we get to do some things here and there.
So you're listening to Brett Mills, the co-CEO of Jesus Said Love here on Downtown Depot. For our listeners who aren't familiar with the mission, explain exactly what Jesus Said Love attempts to do.
Yeah, so we reach out to women in the commercial sex industry to awaken hope and empower change. Simply put, every month we go to strip clubs all over Texas. We're in 7 cities around the state. We build relationships. We bring them gifts every month. And the goal is when they're ready to leave the industry, because everyone leaves the industry at some point, that maybe we can help them, you know, move back into their local communities in some form or fashion.
Now, with something like what you guys do, it's powerful because you can hear the stories. You know, you can see the progress of pulling this woman out of a job that maybe she wasn't really fired up about and now is getting the coaching and the mentorship that she needs from the leadership team to start a new chapter in her life. But you and I were talking before we went to air on how you kind of struggle with sharing those stories because here they are getting exploited up on stage, and then there you are turning around and exploiting their story. How do you balance that, and what can you share with us about some of the success that you guys have had?
Yeah, so it's a fine balance, because at the heart of this thing is exploitation, right? And it's objectifying women. And the last thing we want to do is, you know, the women that we're working with, objectify them in order to increase our donor base. I mean, you know, we've been told numerous times, if you guys would tell more stories, you would have more money. Well, we're not about money. We're about people. And so we have to really navigate that. And one of our litmus tests is if a woman is ready to tell her story, then we will help facilitate that. She gets to tell her own story. It's her story to tell. And so we just recently have had several women who are ready to tell their stories. So we've had more stories that we're willing to share in that sense. And, you know, we encourage them to share whatever you want. Before we put them on camera or on a stage somewhere, we want to we want to help them make sure they're not objectifying themselves or exploiting themselves.
So how do you help them ask those questions? Because those are really hard things to be honest with yourself about.
Sure. I mean, you got to remember 69% of the women we work with suffer from PTSD. That's a fact. We believe that percentage is actually higher, but that's kind of the nationally accepted number. So you don't want someone, when they're in the midst of telling their story, to trigger themselves to this crazy memory when God knows what happened. And so, you know, we spend a lot of time with them telling, you know, they tell us their story and we kind of help. Well, maybe you might want to leave these details out. Maybe these aren't as important as this or that. And we just kind of go from there.
When you are leading events in these strip clubs, do you go personally? And is it typically women inside of the clubs or is it men inside of the clubs?
Yeah, great question. So I used to go to the clubs. It's not feasible all the time for me to go now. Everything has gotten a little bit larger. But we do, they're called the security team. They drive the women to the clubs, help them carry the bags to the door. We don't allow men to go inside. That would kind of defeat the purpose on our end of what we're trying to do. Our club team is trained women who commit to at least a year to serve with us. They go in and, again, the object is not to beat someone over the head with the Bible. It's to just love women where they are and in whatever capacity. So if she's tweaking on meth, we're going to love her tweaking on meth. If she's ready to start her own company, we're going to love her in that instance. So it's everything in between. There's no strings attached. For instance, one story, Emily was in with Emily's my wife. She was in one club and one lady came up and she was real kind of volatile towards her. We had shirts that say Jesus loves strippers. And it's like, Jesus loves strippers. Well, he doesn't love me. She walked off and she came back. She was trying to intimidate Emily. And Emily just kind of held the course of, I'm going to have a seat. I'm going to have a chat. They sat down. They started talking. Girl lit up a cigarette. She was going to try to scare the church lady away with the cigarettes. Emily grabbed the cigarette out of her mouth, took two puffs. And it was that equalizing moment of, oh, wait, you're not here to tell me I'm going to hell. You're actually here because you're caring about me. And so it was just a fascinating moment that some church people would go, oh, you smoked a cigarette? Whereas we kind of go, we built a relationship with someone who we were told you'll never build a relationship with her. Sometimes it's counterintuitive to, you know, always keep it between the lines.
And Brett, that's so powerful because it shows that whether it's in a strip club or it's on the basketball court or it's in the office, meeting someone at their level, it's what's going to feel, it's going to bring the feeling of comfort and closeness that's going to engender progress and change.
Totally. And we love to use, I think language is very important. And I don't like the term level because I think the term level makes me potentially higher or you higher. And I like to use the language, we're going to move towards people. And so in whatever state they are, if I move towards you, that's me choosing to come and find you where you're at and love you with no strings attached.
So it's not an issue of height, it's an issue of distance.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Wow. That's a really powerful image, and especially in 2017 in this politically charged climate that we're living in right now, it feels like people are so far apart.
Yeah.
And this, you know, liberal talking down to a conservative, like that doesn't work.
If
you
people
know?
Could learn how to move towards each other, moving towards someone doesn't mean you agree with them. I don't agree with the man who owns a strip club, but I can move towards him to have meaningful conversations. So for instance, a local club here in town, for 9 years, the owner told me, you and I are on the same team. I give these women a job. You help these women when they're ready to quit. I had a religion degree at Baylor. You went to Baylor. And it's this distorted view of what we're doing here. Now, I could have gone, well, you own a strip club. You're disgusting. You're objectifying these women, and you're a terrible human. Or I could figure out, how can I move towards him, have a meaningful conversation, gain his trust, and now we've totally changed the conversation. But here's the deal. I don't agree with one iota of what you're doing. So it removes all conflictual kind of language and tone and, you know, I'm mad and you're mad. No, we can actually sit here and talk and, you know, hopefully we can move you towards a different way of thinking. Does that make sense?
Are the people who run these clubs hesitant to allow you guys in because they see that you're potentially picking off their workforce?
Yeah, so I think most in the industry understand the women are transient. You know, they dance for a season. They dance to pay off a bill, put some food on the table for their kids. And so they know, you know, they're not hanging around forever. We have demonstrated that our position is to honor the leadership. So when we go in, or when we set up a meeting with a new club, we show them what's in the bags. We show them that we're not here to proselytize their people. We're not here to get their client. We do not touch clients. We don't talk to clients. We don't try to keep clients from going into the strip club. We're there for the women. And so we've built such a strong relationship with clubs across Texas that I think there's only been one club that says don't come back. It turns out it was because they were under investigation and they thought we were the narcs. But other than that, every club is like, yay, y'all are here. You're taking some stress off of me.
Wow. It reminds me of this C-suite parable. The CFO is talking to the CEO and says, what if we invest all this time and money in our employees and they end up leaving us? Mm-hmm. And the CEO says, what if we don't invest our time in our employees and they end up staying?
Yeah.
Those club owners, even in their position, recognize that you are there to benefit their employees. And even if it is giving them a way out, they have to understand that having healthier, happier people on the floor is going to make their clients happier too.
Right. Yeah, definitely. I mean, we are providing, to put in a business terms, a benefit. You know, sometimes our bags have really practical items like, you know, Band-Aids or chewing gum or Advil or things like that. So that club owner now doesn't have to provide that for that woman, as we provided it for them. So,
what an incredible service that Jesus Said Love provides. We're speaking here on Downtown Depot with Brett Mills, co-CEO, along with his wife, Emily. Talk a little bit about working with your wife. At Pokio's, Julia and I work together every day. I'd say in the last 2 years, our ability to cope has really gotten a lot stronger. But Emily and you have been doing Jesus Said Love, and before that, making music for a long time. What are some of your strategies for spending so much time with someone?
Wow. First of all, I would say it's probably not for everyone.
I would second that.
I think that we have worked really hard to know each other, but even beyond that, we are working actively, even now, almost 20 years of marriage, we are working on knowing ourselves as individuals. And so I think I know my lane. She knows her lane. It just so happens that our lanes work really well next to each other. We complement each other. We aren't threatened by each other. We are equal. There is no, well, I'm the man, so I kind of run the show. And it is not that at all. I don't know, man. It's for us, it's a very, very cool thing. I can't imagine doing anything else.
What are your resources for getting to know yourself better?
So we've kind of bought into the Enneagram.
I don't know if you got any.
It's just kind of rocking our world for about the past 18 months.
I'm trying
months.
To figure out whether I'm a 3 or an 8. That's what I'm going through right now.
Okay,
but
well,
you can see yourself in all of them, and so that does lead to a little convolution.
Yeah, it's been helpful for us in marriage. It's changed the way we parent. It's helpful for our organization. I'm an 8. I'm a strong 8. Emily is a 1, a very strong 1. And so we've looked at profiles of what is an 8 and a 1 like in a marriage. And it's almost like somebody put up a camera in our house and in our office and watch how we interact. So it is a, you know, they say the 1 and the 8 together start organizations that change culture. And that's actually kind of what we set out to do, not fully knowing it. For some people watching us, they may go, wow, you guys are really honest with each other, like particularly in conflict. But we, you know, we kind of practice front door communication. I don't go to the side or the back. It's, hey, this bothered me when you did this. And she can come back and said, hey, you were being a total idiot when you said this. You want to talk about that? It's great.
Well, if you're needing to do some serious personality understanding and reassessment, what Brett and I are talking about is the Enneagram, Enneagram.
Yes.
And it is really an ancient way of understanding personalities. It was popularized by the Jesuits, and they break down 9 distinct personality types, and we all are on the spectrum at some level, but the idea is that when you think of yourself as a child, when you think of yourself before all of this other muck that we call life sort of started to weigh down on you. You start to get chips in your armor. Who were you as a child? What turned you on when you were a little kid? And what really brought you joy? And that's what the Enneagram tries to get to the heart of and understand your motivations for why you make decisions the way you do.
Yeah, and it also helps you. It helps keep you centered and grounded. When you start thinking you're awesome, just go spend some time in the Enneagram and you'll realize, wow, I'm a messed up person.
Well, we can all use those reminders to keep us humble. And I would imagine that one of the greatest things about Jesus Said Love is seeing daily reminders, not just of the women that you guys are helping, but the people in your office. And when you talk about being honest with yourself, getting the daily reminders of how much we need help and how reliant we are on being part of a team.
Yeah. I mean, community is everything. I think it's the way that we interact. I mean, we were meeting with the police chief just yesterday, and I told him, I mean, we have this incredible opportunity to make Waco this great progressive city that other cities can look to. And why is that? It's because all these different people from different sects of our culture here in Waco are willing to sit down and go, okay, let's look at these issues. Let's look at poverty. Let's look at art. Let's look at drug and human trafficking. And everybody has a piece of that. That's community. And so we have these opportunities to have that culture in our families, in our office, as well as in our city. So as much as we can be around people, and again, I go back to that term. I say it all the time. Let's move towards each other. Doesn't mean we agree, but we move towards each other so that we can together make change that changes our culture.
It's amazing to see how many groups in Waco have bought into that idea of moving toward each other.
Yeah.
Whether it's Natalie Garnett with Unbound, mm-hmm. Or the work that Prosper Waco's doing. There's so many great civic organizations that really have understood that the only way to move forward is to do it together and to meet people where they are.
Yeah.
So it's amazing to see what Jesus Said Love has accomplished in so few years and knowing what you guys are going to accomplish in the future. So we are so happy to have you here in Waco, Brett, and very gracious that you would spend time with us here on Downtown Depot. Thank you so much for joining.
Thank you, man. What an honor.
That's our show for this week, but be sure to tune in on Friday, June 2nd for a conversation with another inspiring Waco entrepreneur. If you want to keep up in between episodes, connect with us on Facebook and Twitter at Waco Business News. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this interview and the East Waco design debate. And you can also see renderings of the proposed streetscape improvements along Elm Avenue. And if you're tuning into this podcast via iTunes or the NPR One app, why don't you go ahead and give us a few stars, boost that rating. I'm your host, Austin Meek of WacoBusinessNews.com, and you've been listening to Downtown Depot, where we track the ins and outs of Waco business.